dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Welcome once again to Binary Revolution Radio. I am Stank Dog, joining you this week on March 13th, 2007, for episode number 190. Wow, I can't believe we're keep inching closer and closer to 200 episodes, weekly episodes of this radio show. Amazing sometimes when you sit back and think that we started this almost 4 years ago. Just baffling. I can't believe we've kept it going this long. But joining me this week on the show, which is going to be actually a very good show, I think. I'm already, even from the notes, I'm already learning quite a bit. Our good friend Mia Flux is joining us on the show again this week. You were on, weren't you on the gangster episode a couple episodes ago?
Yeah, 187 on Undercover Cop.
There you go. That was the gangster episode 187. So joining us again this week, and we are going to talk about some pretty interesting stuff later on, cross-site scripting related things, but we'll go into some more detail later. First, I do have a little bit of housekeeping to talk about here. I'm not sure, I don't think I mentioned this on the show, or if I did, I didn't talk about it in detail. But we did just relaunch, or I guess, I don't know if I should say launched a new site or relaunching a site, but the people who've been around for a while know that we've run a secure disposable email service for quite a while now called willheckforfood.biz, and it's worked great. It's been up and down a couple times due to some technical issues with our old server, but we are back up on a new server now. That site is back up and running. However, the reason I say launch or relaunch is because willhackforfood.biz actually started off totally as a joke. .biz addresses at the time were like being sold for $1.95 a year or something like that, because they wanted to promote them and get people out there using them. It was when they first rolled out. So we went ahead and got it as a joke, and we thought it was kind of irony that it'd be a .biz that we're begging, like a, you know, having to sign up willhackforfood.biz. So it started off as a joke and just a sandbox for us to do some testing. We never intended it to be a real site. And then when we came up with the idea of secure email from my presentation that I gave at I guess that was Interzone 4, 3, 4, whatever, we created the idea and created the site, and we decided since we already had that domain and it's kind of funny, we'd use it. Well, long story short, which is something I'm not good at making a long story short, willhackforfood.biz is just not the ideal URL to use for email. It's long, first of all, too much to type. The whole point of disposable email is you want to use something real quick and fast and throw something in there made up real fast. .biz is not exactly the best domain because .biz is actually pretty well known. A lot of spam originates from .biz addresses. And it's got the word hack right in the URL, so people could easily put a filter of in not allowing anything with the word hack in it, stuff like that. There's just lots of reasons that it's a bad domain name to use for such a service. So what we've gone ahead and done is registered a new site for that. It's still Will Hack for Food. We'll still refer to it as Will Hack for Food, or WAF for short, but the new domain is wh4f.org, wh4f.org. It's the same thing, same interface, and it works the same way that it always has, so anybody that's been missing it or has forgotten about it, it is back up and running. There are still a few features we want to add to it, like suggesting names, because it's kind of hard to tell which names have been used, but again, disposable, you should just be making up some gibberish stuff anyway, so the odds of a name collision at this early stage in the game is pretty low. So, and actually, I think you've used that site before, haven't you? Didn't you tell me one time that you liked that, the We'll Hack for Food service? Back when we were,
I can't remember offhand.
Yeah, I think back when we were talking about, because I gave the presentation, before I gave it at Dinner Zone, I gave it down at the Fort Lauderdale 2600 meeting using Dodger, an account I created called Dodger on the FL2600.com site where I showed how Dodget.com was vulnerable to this backdoor attack, and that's kind of what gave me the idea for the whole thing. But yeah, that's been quite a while ago. But it's been around.
Wasn't that actually? I think that was at a DC 305 meeting.
Oh, was it? Wow, I forgot all about those too.
Yeah, that was with Diablo back in the day.
Yeah, I forgot all about those too. Well, it's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, that sort of died quietly, but that was pretty good, man.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. All right, so that is still around. So WH4F.org. It's also shorter, easier to type, et cetera, et cetera. So check that out. The only other piece of housekeeping I have is actually kind of story time, if you will. This is kind of a funny story to lighten the show up before we get into some deep tech here. Long-time listeners of the show and long-time friends of mine know that I have a little problem with sleeping. I have horrible, horrible insomnia. I've actually coined the phrase hacker's insomnia, which I think is one of my few articles that you actually liked.
Oh, I love that one.
The hacker's insomnia article. Which was basically a 4 a.m. rant of mine, for lack of a better word, where I just was frustrated with being up yet again another night because I'm always up thinking about code, thinking about stuff, and have problems sleeping. Well, I pretty much had it my whole life. It's just been getting worse and worse. It takes me several hours to fall asleep, and if I wake up in the middle of the night, it's hard to get back to sleep. It just sucks being me. Wah, wah, wah. Emo.
I'm familiar with that too because I think I read that article at like 3:30 in the morning.
see, that's irony.
Yeah, as soon as I read that article, I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to start hanging out with Stank next meeting.
There you go. So, okay, so emo, life sucks, nobody understands me. Anyway, so I finally went and did something about it. I'll make this quick because it might be kind of boring, but I actually finally went, if anybody's ever heard of this, they have something called a sleep study. And no, this is not like some college volunteer to make $50. This is actually something you can go to the doctor. And basically they send you to a sleep study place. I don't know if there's a term for it. But basically it's a glorified hotel or simplified hotel for, I guess, a better word. Where they go in there and they basically attach a whole bunch of wires and sensors to you. And I actually took some camera phone pictures I might have to upload to the website. Even though I know they will be Photoshop material. Photoshop bait. But basically they tape all these sensors to different parts of your face. First of all, it was just pure comedy when I first go into this place. They sit you down in the chair and they measure your head with a tape measure, which is already kind of weird. It's like, what the hell?
And hey, you've got a pretty big head.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's what she said. And every time he would measure the head, my head, he would put a little grease pencil, and he's marking X's all over my head and all over my face and crap like that for everywhere that he was going to connect a sensor. It looked like a fucking tic-tac-toe board or something. It was like 3D tic-tac-toe. I had all of these wires basically running to different parts of my body, on my shins, my chest, my head, the back of my head, my neck, my scalp. I don't know how in the world anybody could... they expect anybody to sleep with these things. I think there were 46 different sensors that they had on me through, I think, 20-something different wires. And they were all stuck to your different parts of your body, and then they put this weird glue-type stuff to keep them from coming off at night while you are trying to sleep. And the cool part about it, and the reason it's worth mentioning on the show, besides the simple hacker insomnia rant, is that all of this stuff is tied back to a computer center. And actually, when I walked in, I walked past, I saw this huge lab they had where, because they have, I think he said, 10 rooms in the center, in the sleep center. And each one of them was tied to someone's room where it could monitor all of their vital signs and all that stuff at night while they slept. So that was kind of cool. And ironically, I was there Saturday night this past weekend, which is, if anybody knows, was the daylight savings night, the mini Y2K, the OMG, my clocks might be off by an hour. Night.
That
so,
causes more problems than you think.
Yeah, well,
across the 2,000 computers.
Come on, what's the worst case scenario? You're off by a freaking hour. Come on. If you've got problems bigger than that, then you didn't code very well to begin with. You've got
all the Outlook users going, oh no, my appointments are off by an hour.
Yeah, exactly. So all this stuff's monitored by a computer. I actually asked them, you know, they give you the general chit-chat, what do you do for a living, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, I'm a computer programmer. Hey, what are the chances I could go back and see your computer system? Because I was curious in how it worked, and they would, of course, not let me do that. This is a medical facility, doctors, privacy, all that kind of stuff comes into play, which was kind of depressing. But okay, I can understand that. So anyway, they hooked me up to all this stuff. Finally, you go in, at least for this one, I went in at 8 o'clock, but you're not allowed to go to sleep until 10, theoretically. And they wake you up at 5 a.m. to be out by 6 in the morning. So, first of all, they're not even giving you 8 hours of sleep, which I think is a pretty crappy sleep study. Second of all, it takes me a while to fall asleep. That's why I'm there. So I'm in there and laying down, finally drift off to sleep after, I don't know, a half hour to an hour, which is a really good night for me. And, well, and now let me describe the room. The room itself was basically a very simple hotel, queen-size bed. It had a chair and, like, dressers and drawers and shit. I don't know what the hell people do in these things for one night to sleep study. I probably don't want to know. But, basically, there is a bed in the center of the room or whatever, and directly across from the bed, as you're laying there and looking at on the ceiling opposite of your head, where your head's laying, there is one of those dome cameras. So it's already kind of like really pervy feeling, like I'm being watched at night while I'm asleep. I was scared to scratch my sack overnight because I didn't know if it was on film and it's going to, you know, I'm going to wake up and find myself on YouTube with my ball sack glued to my leg or something like that. So that was already creepy, and they got a microphone in case you snore or make any noise or talk during your sleep so they can record all that. That's already really creepy. Now, again, I'm under that, I did ask, and I'm, you know, typical privacy policies apply here. This is a medical procedure, so I was assured that that was safe and it wasn't going to end up on YouTube, but you never know. I'm sure some of the funny ones, it's hard to not post them out somewhere. Anyway, go to sleep for what I would guess. They don't give you any clocks. You're not allowed to have a cell phone, anything like that, no interaction. Once they shut the door, you're in there and that's it. So I'm in there for probably what I'm guessing is a half hour to an hour to fall asleep. I'm guessing I slept for maybe 2 to 3 hours, 2 to 2.5 hours. And then the other thing in the room is right behind the bed, right behind your head where you're sleeping, is a speaker where they're monitoring from the other room. They communicate with you. So I'm in there, dead asleep, and all of a sudden, this booming voice comes on and says, well, like, my name, excuse me, Mr. Dog, we need you to roll over onto your back so that we can get a clear reading while you sleep. Because I guess I had rolled over onto my side. But it comes at, like, super high volume, booming. I thought God himself was talking to me or something. Completely startled me. I jump out of bed, like, swinging to kick somebody's ass. I didn't know what the hell was going on. So that was not cool at all. And then...
like that movie, True Genius or whatever, right?
With Val Kilmer. Real genius,
yeah,
Val Kilmer.
Yeah, you remember that one where do that implant in the filling.
Yeah, exactly. And if anybody, that's a, if, any, if no one's,
God, stop touching yourself.
Or I'll put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And actually, that's a great movie. If anybody listening, as far as hacker movies go, it's not so much computer hacking exactly, but it's very scientific, and the people in there have a lot in common with hackers, believe it or not, even though it's more science laser-based storyline. But anyway, I digress. So, I will shorten up, though, simplify the story. Wakes me up out of a dead sleep. I'm completely wide awake because of that. I don't know if that's part of the test. Maybe they're supposed to see how I react if they wake me up in the middle of the night. I don't know. But I couldn't go back to sleep after that. I'm laying there in bed. I'm rolling around. I'm trying to figure out what the hell's going on. I can't fall back asleep. I'm thinking about code. I'm thinking about a problem I had with some PHP I was working on the night before. I'm thinking about some SQL code I got to write Monday when I get back to work. I got all this stuff. I must have been up for probably 2 or 3 hours after that trying to fall asleep and not able to, and I was pissed off that the guy woke me up in the first place. So, all in all, I'm saying that it really, really sucked. I guess that's a short answer to the whole story. I was not happy with it. It was not as clinical as I had thought. It was just downright creepy, and I will not get the results to see if there's anything wrong with me, at least sleeping-wise, that is. We all know that there's a lot more wrong with me than that. Until sometime the end of the month, so maybe I'll keep people up to date and find out if they've if there's anything wrong with me and if Hacker's Insomnia is in fact curable. So, there's some housekeeping. We haven't done like show and tell or story time in a long time, so I guess that is enough to start this show off, and we have a short email section this time, so we have plenty of time to talk about our main topic. So stick with us for a few minutes and let's do some email. And our first email this week is actually, this is a kind of a message to pass on from our good friend Mubix, who's been on the episode of the show before. Mubix was on the USB key. We talked about a lot of cool tools and might be doing some more episodes on that topic in the future, as we'll find out a little bit later here. But he sends in an email because we want to remind all the listeners that coming up on the 23rd of March, ShmooCon is going to be going on that up in Washington, D.C. So the 23rd of March, after all the talks are done, there's going to be a meetup at the Chipotle that's right around the corner from the hotel where ShmooCon is being held. It's going to be 9 p.m. after all the talks, March 23rd at Chipotle. It's how's this for irony? How's this for an address? 2600 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, D.C., 20008. I don't think you could have made that up, that it's 2600 Connecticut Avenue. That worked out pretty good. So he's looking for artists that can make some flyers to hand out at the conference to let everybody know where it's at. So if people want to drift over from the conference, have everybody's logos on it, stuff like that. So if anybody wants to contact him about that, his email address is JD, as in John Doe, JD.MUBIX@gmail.com. And he says the winning submission will get a T-shirt from all the shows and signed version of the flyer. Don't worry, he will buy the shirts, all right. And not only is he buying shirts, he says he's going to be having free beer and food. By the way, you got your beer handy right there, right?
Oh, I got my beer. By the way, do you have your sweet tea?
Oh, I do have my sweet tea. See, you and Logo Sex.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention that at the beginning. You've got your sweet tea. But I've generally got my Guinness. I substituted it tonight for a nice Stella. You know, I figured an icy pint of Stella will do me good.
Well, you and Logos X, we have to get you both liquored up to get you to do the show.
Yeah, it's like you can't talk me into it until I've had at least, like, a couple beers.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly. So if the show degrades after about an hour and you start slurring, you know why. So anyway, free beer and food for everybody in the community, podcasters, vidcasters, and stuff like that. And he said there will be a beer tab for our listeners, but it's probably going to go really, really quickly. Simple Nomad's actually going to be there as a guest of honor, so that's very cool too. So go again. This is after the talks, 9 o'clock, March 23rd at Chipotle, 2600 Connecticut Avenue, just around from the hotel. So go check it out. Meet up with a bunch of the podcasters, vidcasters, radio show host, because I don't like the word podcaster, radio show host, et cetera, et cetera. I, unfortunately, am not going to be able to make it there. I wanted to, but just didn't work out timing for me at work, unfortunately, so I'm not going to be there, but I know the guys from Hack 5 are definitely going to be there. I think, actually, I'm not going to even drop any more names, because I'm not sure who's committed and not committed to going yet, so check out, there's no website, so I guess you can email Mubix at the email address I mentioned earlier if you want any more information or want to get any more details on the meetup. So, if you're in the area or going to ShmooCon, or even if you're not going to ShmooCon, let me clarify, you don't have to have tickets. This is outside of ShmooCon. This is away. So even if you live in the area and weren't able to get tickets or don't want to go to ShmooCon, didn't want to go, you can still meet up afterwards at this. This is completely irrelevant of ShmooCon the way it ended up working out. So I don't know if that's better. That probably is better, so whatever. So our next email comes from Lex. Lex says, when you talked about the Hacker's USB Toolkit in 188, again, that's Mubix's episode, I was pretty surprised that I didn't hear anything about what I think is the most powerful tool I have on my USB drive, a fully bootable Linux system. I run Puppy.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was going to bring up. You know, I heard that on the show last week. And he was talking about all the tools, but I was going to say, you know, most of the more recent computers can boot up straight from USB. So, I mean, a Linux distro is pretty handy.
Right, right. And, of course, we won't go into the security vulnerability of booting from a USB and allowing your computer to boot from that, but yeah. And you know, and actually, let me finish reading this, and then we'll address it. He says, I run Puppy Linux, and that's puppylinux.org, all one word, on my 128-meg flash drive. It's specifically designed for this kind of situation or for similar cramped conditions, such as a small sliver of a hard drive or a live CD. What's pretty neat about Puppy and others is that it saves all the changes I make to any part of the file system using UnionFS. For a USB stick, it dumps the changed files to a little ext3fs in a file. For multi-session CD mode, it actually burns a new session with the ext3fs onto the CD, and at next boot, the most recent session is loaded up. Pretty neat. So now I carry on in my pocket a little Linux distro with all the hacking tools I could possibly need, with a nice graphical X session, Firefox, media players, and lots of system diagnostic and repair tools. If I need a new tool, I just download it and install it, and it'll be there next time I boot. Any computer that'll let me boot a USB drive, and that's most of them now, as MiaFlux just referred to, can be an instant Linux box. Your show inspired me to get back under the hood of my Puppy system. Now the saved ext3 file system on my USB stick is written using the Crypto Loopback driver, so a password is required to boot into my keychain and get at my files. TrueCrypt is great, but this is even more powerful because it requires no thought, and my files are always protected. From Lex. Pronunciation, L-E-X. Now, see, it's always the guys with the easy handles that give me a pronunciation key. Like, I'm sitting here stumbling going, is it Lex or is it Leeks or Lexa? I can handle Lex, but for those of you with a little bit more complex handles, send me a pronunciation key. But Lex, I got that one.
Yeah, I'm always confused at the people who, like, look at my name and interpret it as something different, because I figure, you know, M-E-A-F-L-U-X could only be read so many ways, you know, but it's amazing how many people will confuse, like, the F for a T and be like, oh, Meelux, or the less unappropriate things. And I'm like, no.
I was trying to keep the show clean this week, but I failed miserably.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Actually,
I think it's the UX and the whole, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But honestly, I never even thought really of joking around with your handle until you brought it up. You're the one that said people call you Meat Flux, and we started calling you... Anyway.
Yeah, well, that was IRC, exactly.
Right, that's
exactly.
Joking around.
So, I mean, you know, in IRC, anything goes. You got such, you know, knobs out there that they just, you know, sort of...
Oh.
Themselves in, but
meat and
yeah,
knobs.
Yeah. I've always been amazed. The whole Dr. Zygman thing with the carrot. I wanted to pronounce that, you know.
Yeah, carrot Zygman. I did do that with him all the time, joking around. I think I'm going to change my handle now to Meat Knob, meat_knob, just because I like the sound of it.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, I'm just waiting for somebody to have a handle with, like, you know, an exclamation point in front of it and be like, you know, bang Bob, like, you know, like a exclamation point Bob, you know, or something like that.
I think I am.
You gotta have one of those ones where, like, it'll be humorous for people to understand what the actual characters mean, but a lot of people just seem to think, like, you're more elite the more numbers and, like, special characters you throw in there.
Would I get sued for copyright if I made exclamation bus? Would they sue me from Bang Bus?
Probably. Yeah, that's probably a pretty good handle. You just have exclamation point bus.
I wonder if
not to know that people, you know.
That's actually an interesting question.
Is bang.
That's actually just kind of a, joking aside, that is kind of an interesting question, because what if you did take an elitized version of a company name or a something like that? I wonder how legally that would work itself out.
As long as their lawyers have money, you're screwed.
Well, yeah, you're always going to get buried in the money, but on principle, I'm curious how that might be. I mean, there's fair use and parity protection and stuff like that, but I wonder if I don't know. Anyway,
yeah.
just popped into my head.
I was going to say about, like, the Linux distros. I know I've played around with DSL and stuff like that. I haven't gone too far down the rabbit hole for booting different OSs from USB, but it's been pretty handy. I've had a couple of friends who are technicians, too, and they've just run, like, virus scanning and adware scanning tools from Linux on their And that way, you know, like, if there's any issues, I mean, like, I had a problem on my uncle's computer. I remember a few months back where he specifically couldn't delete a couple of different files. And he's fairly proficient. He's an engineer. He's the guy who probably got me into computer programming. He could not delete these specific files from his system. And they were being loaded every single time the computer loaded. Now, we could, like, you know, edit the registry keys and stuff like that. But we couldn't, even from DOS, well, DOS didn't have, you know, NTFS, but I went into NTFS DOS. NTFS DOS still wouldn't let us, you know, delete the file. So I pretty much ended up having to use, like, a Linux Live boot CD to go through and delete the files so that it wouldn't reinfect the machine and then, remove the registry keys.
Right.
And at that point, you know, times like that, you know, it makes sense that a lot of technicians, you know, a lot of computer repair people are even switching to Linux for the diagnostics and recovery tools, you know.
Certainly. And that's why they rose in popularity so much. But again, you just, like you said, that, and that's what I was going to say, is I still just boot from a Linux bootable CD. You know, I still haven't bothered to really investigate or look into a bootable USB key. I know that a CD is going to work no matter how old the hardware is, how old the system is. If I can boot from the CD-ROM drive, I've got everything there, and I got more storage space on the CD. Well, you know, unless you got a 1 gig plus or 600, you know, more than 660, 700 megs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're not like, you know, all the noobs. We're like old school, you know. Like, I used to carry, I remember when I used to repair computers, I would carry around, you know, like, essentially a freaking, you know, briefcase full of CDs, you know.
See,
and
I'm even...
Most of those utilities, you can just toss it onto a USB drive and, like, boom, you're done.
You're not old school. Old school, I walked around with a little carrying case of, like, 15 floppy disks.
Is that what you're going to say?
Actually, I did have computers that used cassettes to store data on as well, but I was talking more along the... having a diskette that was like an old... Remember, back in the old gaming days, you used to have to carry a boot disk with you so you could run memory managers and whatnot. So I always had a memory manager disk for any purposes. It's back in the old Windows 3 days. A virus scanner, some utility tools, DOS shells, stuff like that. So, diskettes, baby.
Yeah, the 5.25-inch floppies where you had, like, 14 disks for a game, and it always told you, you know, insert disk 7 of 15.
Yeah, that was the days. Boy, that was...
I remember that. Actually, that was a little bit more old school. I'm going to try not to date myself anymore as I'm about to turn 25, so...
Oh, man. I don't even remember when I was 25. Anyway, all right, so let's see, where were we? I guess it goes without saying that, you know, there's tons and tons of things we could have talked about on putting on a USB drive. I mean... I'm sure we missed quite a bit. That's why we put the call out. If anybody had some suggestions or things worth mentioning, to email us and let us know. You know, we've got a limited amount of time on the radio show to talk about it, so we specifically singled out and chose those few things because we thought it was a good mix of some things people know, but then again, some other ones that they may not know. So we kind of tried to mix it up. But we've actually talked about maybe doing some future episodes by theme or genre or relationship of tools. Like maybe we'll do one of a bunch of different scanning tools that you can that are very portable, or a bunch of different, you know, like application level stuff that's actually useful to you, like OpenOffice portable, Firefox portable, stuff like that. So we're definitely never going to hit all of them. It's one of those so big of a topic that we're never going to fit it all into one or even many episodes. There's always going to be something we miss. So that's why we want our listeners, to mail us and let us know of some cool things that they have found, because certainly there's stuff that we have missed. So we still got a good amount of time left for the show to dedicate to this main topic, because this one's going to be, let me preface this and say it's going to be a little bit tricky with this topic because it's very technical and it's going to be kind of hard to translate some of this on radio, but Mia Flux and I have been talking about this for a couple of weeks of how we could pull this off, and got some good notes together. So we're going to jump into it, give it a shot. We're going to try to be careful not to drop too many code snips, or when we do, we're going to try to give you some examples, some links to some pages where you can actually view them while you're listening along with the show. And even if you need to go back and re-listen to a show or rewind or whatever, you can do that too, so that might be helpful. But that main topic that I'm referring to is cross-site scripting, as well as cross-site request forgery, or forgery request, I've seen it said both ways, So we're going to talk about those two things are commonly mentioned together. And specifically, I think, and you tell me here, we're going to kind of talk about this, a lot of relationships between this and Ajax, because Ajax is making these things a lot more, I don't know, not deadly is a bad word,
yeah.
A lot more useful, a lot more, I don't know, a lot more common, I guess, is a simple way of saying it.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I guess, I mean, I'll let you kind of roll with this, because I'm not, like I said, it's such an all-encompassing thing, I don't even know exactly where to start. I mean, some history a little bit, I guess, we want to lay some foundation down to start with, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's, like you just said, there's about 15 different ways we could spin this, and I could probably make several episodes, so I guess pretty much just going to lay the foundations and a lot of basic information to get people started, and if they're interested, we can probably go from there in future episodes.
All right,
but I guess I'd like to talk about, history of, say, like XML HTTP request and essentially what AJAX is nowadays and how it got there. Originally, people got the type of AJAX response by using iframes and layers, and that was in Internet Explorer 3, which was released in 1996, and Mozilla 4 in 1997. Mozilla ended up copying it to get that functionality, and that's because people got tired of the general, HTTP model, which is go through, click on a link, entire page refreshes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So they said, hey, let's stick, layer in here, an iframe in there, and when somebody does anything on a web application, we'll just upload that portion of the page.
Now, frames.
Then that evolved. What's that?
I was going to say, frames is generally an IE term, and layers is generally the Mozilla term. They're like interchangeable with each other, different. That's back when the browser wars were still going on, right?
Exactly. Okay. Now, there's frames which work across both of them, but iframes are specific to Internet Explorer,
right.
And layers are specific to Mozilla, originally. I guess it was spelt Mozilla, but pronounced Netscape, if you want to get particular.
Well, yeah.
People may get pedantic with that, so you have to go ahead and cover my bases. So those evolved into, on Microsoft's side, Microsoft's remote scripting, MSRS. And basically what it did is it involved JavaScript on the client and a Java applet to achieve some of the same effects. And that still was lacking in some ways, and Microsoft pushed and put in XML HTTP request in their browser with Internet Explorer 5. Now, what that was is that through JavaScript, you could actually pull back an XML response from another website. And, it got used all sorts of ways, whether it was just straight HTML or XML, and parsed on the JavaScript side, et cetera, et cetera. But it was very useful, and it got implemented later on in Mozilla, Firefox, Opera, et cetera, et cetera, a little bit later. Ajax was coined by Jesse James Garrett in February 2005, but the reason why I'm talking about it earlier, all those earlier things led up to it. So a lot of people, think Ajax, which is asynchronous JavaScript and XML, was a new thing. As soon as it hit in, February 2005, there were loads of people going, oh, my God, I didn't know you could do that.
OMG, Web 2.0.
These two people have pretty much been doing it since, 96. So it was almost 10 years later that the technology sort of came to fruition in popularity, would probably be the better word on that one.
So Web 2.0 started back in 1996, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, essentially, for these two people.
Yeah.
The problem was is that a lot of, developers, a lot of web developers didn't know about it, and a lot of clients weren't, screaming for it. Nowadays, it's pretty hard not to find a company that wants to make everything as fast as that Google thing,
Yeah.
People look at their webmail or they look at something else or any basically, web-based application and they go, oh, hey, I remember looking at Dell a few years back before the whole Ajax hype, and they used to have on their driver search, they would have a drop-down. You could select, the baseline model, and then it would have specific models that would pop up right after that. And I remember seeing that initially and thinking that was really cool, it was unusual. Nowadays, you know, everybody has an AJAX application. You know, it's practically, you know, well, the website of 1993 or 4, you know, every company was like, we got to have a website, you know.
Right.
But,
And the thing is, though, it's really useful. I mean, they can be. What's frustrating nowadays is that, yes, like you're saying, everybody wanted a website back then. Now everybody wants a Web 2.0 site. They want an AJAX site. And unfortunately, they're pushing out a lot of AJAX just for the sake of it. It's not even really doing anything that useful that's worth putting it out for. And I know we're going to say this later. I guess I'm setting this up for later on, is when you throw stuff up quickly and sloppily like that without doing it properly, you're bound to leave a lot of holes in there, and that is exactly what's happening and where a lot of this stuff is coming from. But we're definitely going to come to that later, right?
Exactly. Okay, so. And I mean, that's the thing. Like, I've been developing AJAX applications for over a year now, and I used some of these tricks earlier on, actually, to tell you the truth, except for it wasn't really called AJAX then. But my nickname in the office is actually AJAX. They call me AJAX. So, if that should give you any indicator, but
what do they call you behind your back? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. XML HTTP request object, you know. Microsucks, whatever.
Well, yeah, we won't even go into that. I had some fun problems before we got recording today, didn't I? But anyway, let's stick to the topic here. So,
I mean, like back in those days, before AJAX really even came around, there's something that ties into it, and it was actually on a WebMonkey article on cross-site scripting a while ago. He's actually, I can't remember the guy's name on WebMonkey that wrote the article, but he specifically started using XSS instead of CSS, because, of course, CSS was around before then for cascading style sheets and something else. I can't recall at the moment. But so he basically said, that's really stupid. We should actually be using XSS instead of CSS. So in that one, he had a really interesting thing about a guy who used to go through and check guest books. And the thing was that a lot of the guest books would just take the text and put it into the page and display it as, you know, just standard text in HTML page. Now, what this guy would do is he would actually go through and post an image tag in the middle of his text for a picture of Barney the dinosaur. And he went around for a while, and I guess it was pretty popular, and they would go around to all these guest books online and just post this image tag in the middle of the text, and all the pages would render it and show, you know, because they weren't stripping any of the HTML tags, they were showing, you know, Barney the dinosaur in the middle of their guest page. So.
Well, it's better than Goatsy or the Weightlifter or something.
Yeah, I'm sure there was probably a couple of people who stuck like Tub Girl in there, you know.
I'm
but
sure, yeah.
I'm trying to be less malicious on this and actually talk about somebody who, you know, just put a big purple dinosaur on your guest book. So
I don't know, that's pretty offensive too, actually, if you think
about it. Yeah, I mean, especially if you're like one of the old school like lead people, it's like, you know, yeah, I've been programming on a Mac since like 1977.
Somebody's gonna take a picture of Barney and Photoshop it with Tub Girl and want a picture of Barney.
Oh God!
Shooting a fountain into his.
I guess after this article, people can probably, you know, maybe there'll be a resurgence in Barney's, you know.
Oh, great!
That's why I wanted to sort of go there a little bit.
I don't want to be responsible for that. Anyway, all right. Yeah, you're right. Let's go back on topic.
Yeah, so basically when I was talking earlier about refreshing certain portions of the page, there's something along that came along that really helped AJAX, and that's DOM, or the Document Object Model. And essentially what that is you can go through and add portions to a page, remove portions from a page, and update portions of a page from JavaScript code. So you can go through and essentially just have, like, an HTML page, which is just JavaScript, and generate all the HTML for that page and make it dynamic straight from JavaScript. In fact, a lot of AJAX development is pretty JavaScript heavy. You know, there's primarily the backend is for supplying the data, and a lot of the behavior and logic is on the front end. So with that, I sort of wanted to segue into different types of cross-site scripting attacks. And the first type of attack that I wanted to talk about is actually DOM-based. Now, basically what it is remote execution vulnerabilities for any HTML not encoded using HTML entities can go through and bypass the client-side sandbox by running trusted within the local zone and possibly exploiting the entire system. Now, what that means is that if any of the code is run locally, like let's say you go through and open up an HTML file locally on your computer, like you save a file and open it up.
Right.
You can go through, and at that point, an HTML file that you open on your system is inherently trusted by Windows. So you can go through and have a JavaScript snippet in that page that will remotely go back, grab code, and execute it locally that would allow it to, say, have access to files on your hard drive and go through, grab the contents of those, and put it on another site. Now, that's fairly rare in that you'd actually have to have an HTML page locally on the user's system that they would open up. But you could do something like have, say, an HTML or an HTM file or something like that that wouldn't open by default, you know, or have a link where somebody saves a file and just save the HTML file and open it in the browser. And at that point, you can essentially root their box from your script alone. So this isn't like drive-by, you know, drive-by downloads and stuff like that. It's a little bit more complex and one of the lesser seen cross-site scripting exploits, but it's still possible. And basically a famous example for that one was Google had a website that was identified and published by Yair Amit in December 2005. And the vulnerabilities allowed an attacker to impersonate legitimate members of Google services or mount, like, phishing attacks and whatnot. And basically the way they did that is they bypassed common cross-site scripting countermeasures by using UTF encoded payloads. And I'll get into that a little bit later on, but it's how browsers actually interpret Unicode. If they properly interpret Unicode, you can go through and alternately encode information so that it's launched.
Right. Right. You know what? Now that I'm sorry. I was going to say now. Since you mentioned that, that's actually something that we probably should do an episode on, just talking about different encoding and how it relates to navigation on the global interweb and stuff, because there are a lot of nuances and interesting things there.
Yeah, I'd be happy to go into something like that at a later date because
yeah, for sure.
I've dealt with that a few different times. Like when I went to my SQL injection presentation a while ago, we got into canonical names and whatnot a little bit. Like I said, you know, I just wanted to go over essentially what the first type would be. It's not seen that much. I haven't really found a use for doing something like that. You know, it exists, so I just felt I had to go over that. The
right.
Second type, which is pretty much the most common one, is non-persistent or reflected vulnerability. And that basically injects code on a URL to a third-party site, and you embed it. For instance, you could go through and send somebody a URL-encoded or standard script tag embedded in, I mean, like, it doesn't have to be URL-encoded. You could encode it through a couple different mechanisms.
But
essentially, you just send the link to somebody, say, you know, Citibank password change or whatever like that, and they show you the link, and even if you look at the location of the link, it shows that it's Citibank. So it really looks legit, and along with, you know, forging, you know, mail headers and whatnot like that, I remember back in the day when I used to, you know, send emails from Christina Aguilera.com or Britney Spears.com to some of my friends. So it's fairly easy to actually, you know, forge emails. And you go through and say, you know, like, here's a link from Citibank to change your password. It's actually really the Citibank change password page, but it's loading your script at the end, grabbing the cookie and doing other malicious things.
Right. And you actually gave an example here that I'm going to read for the audience to look at. And we put it, I actually tinyurl'd it, tinyurl.com, YUGM3G. So if you want to do that, that's a simple example, but it shows you that basically you are simply going up to the URL box up there, your navigation bar, and you are putting in an HTTP request to the site, but you are slipping in some code, injecting some code in there that's going to, in this case, just pop up a little message. but it's using the same formatting. Well, using the proper formatting, I should say, it could be a lot more damaging, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, that's one thing that I did want to stress. This tiny URL link is just going to exploit one. I mean, one of the most common examples is using a search engine. You know, like, hey, I searched for this, and most of the time, most of the search data is URL encoded anyways. Mm-hmm. People use spaces and special characters and everything, so it doesn't really look out of place. It's especially prevalent in that. So in this case, I went through, and actually Google and Yahoo strip it out now, and uh-huh. I tried a couple different attacks, and well, I mean, not attacks. I was playing. Don't sue me. put me in prison. I want to go to, you know, federal prison. But basically, I went through and somebody recently turned me on to that particular search engine, and the search assistants are less than helpful. So I, on a whim, decided to check out that one, and wonder of wonders, the poorly formatted search engine actually ended up exploiting my code. My code exploited it. So that was just one example. It's all over the place. If you play around with different search engines, you can probably find a lot and use some of the examples that we go into later on. This is probably the most common, like, phishing attack in that, you know, they can go through and spam this to, like, a gazillion people, and the five that click on it, it's not even, and this is, like, the next step. One of the, you know, more popular ones that's already out there that a lot of people know of is they'll send you, you know, you need to change your PayPal account or something else, and it'll be, like, xyz.biz, you know, like Sank was saying earlier, right. You know, you're going to think, oh, of course, this is a phishing attack.
Well, and there's other indicators. I mean, first of all, any long URL you should be fishy about anyway. If it's got a bunch of what appears to be gibberish, it's, you know, different hex codes or different offsets for different characters that you can't really put into a... Well, anyway, it goes back to encoding, which we're not going to go to that again. But if you see a long URL is what I'm getting at, you should be suspicious because you don't know what all it's going to be doing. So anytime you see a long URL from anywhere, whether it's Citibank, PayPal, or whatever,
yeah, exactly.
You should
what
all be...
Say. It doesn't matter where it's from. Like, if you see a long URL, go to the actual, you know, specific URL yourself and check it out if it's a URL that you trust. But don't trust any link, even if the email looks legit, even if the root domain is your actual, you know, bank, PayPal, or whatever else, because the thing that I wanted to drive home is most people will still see this, and they'll go, oh, well, it must not be a phishing attack, because it's actually from Citibank.
Right,
you know?
Right. And there is a limit of how much you can put in a domain, in a string like that. There's going to be a limit, but the example that we're using here is again, very simple, just a confirmation box that pops up, but... The point being, that's just a simple illustration. That could easily be grabbing that and doing a remote insert into MiaFlux's box or someone else's box somewhere else. So it could be doing a whole lot more. So that's why you want to worry. The longer it is, the more it's probably trying to do. Now, actually, I have a question for you on this. I mean, this is a form of URL manipulation, which I've written articles about in the past, and I always love I love messing with URLs when I go to different sites to see what I can get into. So my question to this is, okay, that's one form, is a GET request. Well, what can I actually use POST parameters to do the same thing? Can I actually inject script, this same type of script, using a POST to a website?
Yeah, and I'm going to get into that a little bit later on when I actually start getting more into, like, cross-site request forgery and stuff like that.
Right.
But some people will try and avoid that by actually doing, you know, like, moving away from a GET page and moving it to POST. But what a lot of people don't understand is you can actually change a form from POST to GET to a page. So depending on how the receiving page handles it, you can still post all of those variables. You can scan through, you know, like the document.getElementById and grab through, you know, or like just go through the entire document, grab all the IDs, and then post it with that same data. But that's not going to be the type 2 attack generally. You're not going to be doing that.
That's a different type.
Generally through the URL. Exactly.
Okay.
And that moves us on to pretty much the third type, which is stored or persistent or second order vulnerabilities. And that's when the script is stored permanently on the server without being encoded using HTML entities. Now, that's generally, a lot of times, you'll find that on forums and whatnot. People will have their footer image or, you know, can make their text red or make it bold, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of these sites allow users to go through and use HTML in there. Unfortunately, since they're not really going through and using HTML entities, you can use the same attacks in the second one, but you can embed the script directly. So it would be like if somebody said, you know, put your avatar here, and you do something like, like image source, and then an image that doesn't exist, and then, on error, go through and load your script.
Right.
You know, something like, you know, doesn't exist .jpg, you know, and then a space, you know, single quote, on error equals, quote, you know, alert document dot cookie.
And
look at your document cookie like straight there, and anyone who goes through there, it wouldn't just be alert, of course, you'd actually go through and you'd send the information. You could use the XML HTTP request object with that code to actually remotely send anybody's cookie who looked at your site. And in cases like ORCID and stuff like that, they actually went through and were able to get into users' accounts. There's a lot of different types. Like, there was a Yahoo cross-site scripting worm that pretty much, as soon as the page loaded, it would go through, grab all of your contacts, and then send them all of the mail. And that was purely, you know, cross-site scripting. That was all JavaScript-based. They actually went through, grabbed all of the, you know, contacts in your account book, and emailed itself. So it didn't infect your computer, but it certainly, you know, sent the email and propagated itself to all your friends. And that's something that, you know, spam people could actually go through and use to get massive amounts of email. You know, you go into your Hotmail or Yahoo accounts, and boom, somebody's got all of your email and all of your contact emails. So.
And since you've got them saved, they're more likely to be valid emails. They're not just farmed emails that could be old or expired. They're probably active email addresses. But actually, wasn't this the same technique also that was used on that big MySpace thing with the friends growing exponentially? Which is,
yeah,
I think,
was,
a great story.
This is the same type that was used on the MySpace worm. This guy added like a million friends to his friends list. And I think he got legal action taken against him. I can't remember specifically.
Ooh.
But there was another company, and I think they mentioned it last week, actually, or somebody did, but there was actually a group of people that had a number of cross-site scripting attacks and exploits that they did, like grabbing your friend's, you know, password, et cetera, et cetera. And those two people, they were actually, I think, selling them. And they went through and posed enough of a threat that MySpace actually went to them and went like, you know, like, I think they propositioned them and said, you know, well, you can hire us to do your security or pay us money. And MySpace goes, okay, you know, we'll hire you at some exorbitant sum. They go into the interview, and there's like FBI agents waiting there to take them to jail. So I thought that was funny. I mean, you know, like, I've never been a malicious person. So when I've played with most of this stuff, I've had, you know, my own servers. I've, you know, infected my own computers, et cetera, et cetera. Because I don't necessarily need the money or want to follow, you know, malicious steps to get ahead, you know.
Right,
it just
right.
doesn't make sense to me. But I've always been interested in the security aspect, so I'd say I'm probably like white or gray hat, probably, at worst.
Right.
And,
now, this actually, to me, is, I know the other one may be the most common, I don't know, whatever most common, but the one I think the people are most familiar with is this style of attack. This is the kind of thing that is most common and most interesting, in my opinion, just personal opinion. And this is the kind of thing, though, that, I mean, it helps to have your own server to run this from, right? I mean, it's not something you're going to be running.
Well, yeah, if you have cookies and other information like that, of course, you need to actually send the information somewhere. So most of the time, this third attack is used, or even the second attack, second and third type of attacks, are used with an external server to record the information. So at that point, you actually use the XML HTTP request object to send all that data that you just grabbed from JavaScript, and you just log it onto your server. So whether it's a botnet or, you know, some
right, but ironically,
proxy server of a proxy server.
And that's just a thing, is ironically, you don't want this traced back to your server, most likely, what you're doing with this kind of stuff. So you're doing
if you're stupid. Around with this, definitely don't, like, send all the information to your home machine.
Right.
Things like that are where, you know, you start end up getting, you know,
technically,
met by the FBI. And
right. Technically, it would work. I mean, if you got a static IP or you're running your own website. But, I mean, it's so easy to find where it's going. And that's where, you know, all these botnets or previously exploited boxing come into play is... You know, it's someone else's box that you're launching these attacks from. So you've got that extra layer of obfuscation in there, that extra layer of separation in between you and the victim, I guess, for lack of a better word. Also, and actually, this is kind of funny. I don't know if this is... Let me bounce this off of you. What if... Isn't it possible then, by the nature of this type of attack, to use some sort of injection vulnerability on site A, on one site, inject some code in there that actually launches... a cross-site scripting attack to a second site, site B, like neither, not even your site, they don't even have to be your sites. Like site A, you go and put some code in there, that code goes over to site B looking for a particular string or looking for a particular script over there, and you put your script on box B, which in turn goes back to A. So you could actually have this funny scenario where you've got an infinite loop between two different boxes performing cross-site scripting attacks on each other, and each one subsequently sets off a trigger causing it to attack the first one, so it goes back and forth. You could actually have this weird infinite loop theoretically. I mean, isn't that possible?
Definitely it's possible. And I mean, you know, but even more probable, I would say, is that we're going to start seeing a lot of worms and a lot of the, you know, phishers and spammers moving away from directly exploiting the machines. I mean, that's still going to be a huge thing. But I'm saying, because of cross-site scripting, the fact that you can go into, you know, a central repository of all of this information that's normally considered secure and be able to crack it so easily makes it a much better target than, say, one person's computer with their Outlook contacts, you know.
Right, right. Well, we've got...
And I mean, what I would see in the future, probably more likely than just, you know, looping each other to death or something like that, would be like, you know, one site going through and, say, grabbing other links, you know, that are on the page or, you know, browser history and exploiting them and seeing if they have the vulnerabilities and then installing themselves on them. What I mean is, you know, going through and actually exploiting multiple other websites. But you could use it for obfuscation in that end of going through and, you know, upload this to some, you know, minor site and have it go through and do your other attacks for you. But you're still going to need a couple of hops between you and the first injection point if you actually want to do it that way.
Right. Now, we've got, like, I don't know, about 20 minutes or so left in the show, so... I think we should probably mention also another point that you made earlier, and that is there's a relationship between cross-site scripting attack and cross-site request forgery. So you want to differentiate a little bit on that?
Yeah, basically what it is you're using the same types of... you're using the same tools, but for a different effect. Now, where those first three were primarily targeting users' machines... The fourth type, well, I would still classify it as XSS, but it's generally referred to XSRF. And it's specifically going through and using that client-ran code to exploit the web server. Now, I had talked about this before in, like, my SQL injection script about how you could go through and automatically use, you know, like, Perl to go through and post to pages and check if their form fields... Like, if you have JavaScript validation and you say, like, you know, max width is 40 or whatever like that, and your backend isn't going through and limiting it to 40 characters, you can still go through and post with a script from your machine and put that code into it. So if you're stripping out, you know, like, JavaScript tags and other stuff like that on the front end, on the back end, you can still attack it. And this makes it a lot easier in that... You know, most of the security is definitely through obscurity for Ajax apps. There's a lot of sensitive information, and just poking around a little bit, you see how much is, like, just sort of hung out there, because a lot of people haven't put the proper effort into security in their applications. That's
right.
One thing that I'm always, you know, pissed off about is, I can understand, you know, like a 500,000 line, you know, desktop application or like a 500 million line desktop application or something like that, you know, there's going to be some flaws in there, but people really don't pay attention to security, even in simply, you know, web applications. And you can go through and, you know, like I said before, people going through and storing in the cookie user IDs, user passwords, other sensitive user information, and that's on the client end. But on the server end, you could go through and post to a page and use it for additional injection vectors. So you could do, you know, SQL injection. You'd actually do direct code injection or try and do buffer overflow attack on the actual web server, all from your JavaScript, you know. So you could have this script go through, load your local page on your machine, then load another page within it. It grabs it. It, at that point, has access to all of the actual JavaScript functions, all of the actual objects that are embedded in it, like all the new stuff that's pulled back via the XML HTTP request object. So even if you have an AJAX application like Google Mail, you can have it go through, and normally, I guess what I should make a little bit clearer is, you go into Gmail or you go into Google Maps or anything like that, and you right-click and you say View Source. All of the updated information from the point from which you've logged in and probably hit a couple of things on their menus has been changing, and you're not going to see that on View Source. But you can access that information with your JavaScript. So you can go through and look at all of the different information in the page and build an attack based on that, and then try code injection and SQL injection. So it's really like the same old hat, but with a new vector.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know if that's very interesting to a lot of people, but I've had a lot more fun with that, especially since I write AJAX applications, to see where the vulnerabilities are and how I can better design that code.
Right, right. No, that's, I think that's really interesting. I bet a lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen stuff on other applications and source that people have posted where they go through and they essentially have like an inline query, and it's an AJAX app, and they go, you know, oh, it's not a direct form, you know, whatever, whatever, I'm doing JavaScript validation and they can't see the JavaScript, so I'm okay. Well, no, you can't just bypass all those, you know,
right,
security methods you had before just because nobody can see it now, because for, you know, the intelligent user, for all intents and purposes, I can see everything that you have there. You're not hiding anything from me as an intelligent user if I want to go through and, for some reason, be malicious.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, in this case, the first read, you know, you're dealing with a lot more users that you can potentially infect. But with this one, you can actually go through and say, get access to somebody's database. You know what I mean? So
right,
even if the first three types of attacks aren't useful for some black hat person, their next step would probably be using cross-site request forgery to actually get direct access to that data.
Right.
You know, if you couldn't add a million friends, you might find a way to actually exploit the server so that you could add a million friends on the back end. What,
yeah,
I'm saying.
Yeah, right, right, right. Well, I tell you what, we're running down to like about 10 minutes or so. So, did you want to go into some more detail about this, or would you rather talk about mitigation and some stuff that can be done about it, or how do you want to wrap this up, or what do you want to make sure we cover?
Well, just I guess I'll just do a quick run through on you know, like some different vectors, and then sort of tie it up and go into security.
Okay.
But you know, I'd already talked about you know, using the on-error tag. You can actually use onload in iframes, bodies, windows, and images. And images are the most common way of that. So that's
yeah,
a very common way to actually go through for the third type of attack. And a lot of data is not encrypted or obfuscated on the client side. You know, like I said, there's too much trust. So you got to lock it down and leave as little data on the front end as you can as possible. You can change the form.method specifically. If you look in JavaScript for DOM, it's called form.method, and you can change it to post or get with JavaScript. So if you're playing with a new page, like you go through and you scrape any URLs in JavaScript to see what pages they're interacting with, if they're not like a regular get, you can go through and try posting some of the IDs with your own data.
Right. See, I really like that one. Is really cool to me. I like that. I think that's a really cool concept.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, make certain mechanisms like, you know, HTTPS completely vulnerable, because although you're not being able to like sniff on the actual traffic between the user and the site, this is running from the site. So even if you have HTTPS directly in and you're being exploited, like, they can still grab all the information from the client and all of that, you know, data that they're pulling, all the HTML, all the JavaScript code, et cetera, et cetera. You could probably make, you know, a playback that would pretty much give you all the information that somebody hit on a site from beginning to end, depending on how advanced your attack was. So, I guess basically I'll go lightly into what can be done, you know, from a developer and administrator end for mitigating these injection vectors.
Right.
And, you know, basically it's a hard road to a certain extent. You know, it gained popularity and people are just cracking down on it now, but browsers are going to have, you know, trouble tightening the entity controls, because with the advent and popularity of mashups, you know, going through and using the XML HTTP request object to gain information from a bunch of different sites and put a new front on it. Like, I think there was a mashup that actually took crime rates in New York City and actually made it so it displayed an image with an overlay that would show you all the most dangerous areas of, say, Chicago or New York, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And a lot of those are really useful. So they go through and use, you know, an API from a specific site. And with cases like that, if you go through and you limit execution of JavaScript to that site only and make it so XML HTTP request only works within that same domain, then you're going to completely kill a very popular line of Web 2.0 type applications. Because mashups are huge if you've been following any of the Web 2.0 stuff.
Yeah, it's only going to get bigger. It's only going to get bigger.
Exactly,
I mean,
exactly. And that's a big problem, is what I'm saying, is they can't really lock down XML HTTP request to the same URL, because the usefulness of it is sort of the crux of it, too.
Right, it outweighs the dangers.
Yeah.
Or in the developer's mind, it does anyway.
Yeah, for the most part. But like I said, most people never even think about, you know, security until... we've got a major problem. There's a million friends added to somebody, or we're Orkut and somebody stole like 5,000 users' email addresses and, you know, like login IDs and passwords and shit like that, you know.
Right.
But basically, any JavaScript validation, there's something webform_callback is used in all of the iCallbacks with .NET. So .NET has what they call an iCallback, which is sort of a higher-level XML HTTP request. And they generate all of that actual script and make it, quote-unquote, secure. But you can still use the webform_callback JavaScript function to inject your own information into the callback. So it's still possible to actually attack, even if they're using iCallbacks or other higher-level things, because on the lower level, it's still an XML HTTP request object.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said before, that's a definite vector. I mean, I specifically do a lot of .NET development. You know, I like writing, you know, in open source software very much. But unfortunately, I have to do a lot of .NET programming too. Well, it's not bad. C Sharp isn't bad. But HTML quoting algorithms also are particularly thwarted by or potentially thwarted by browsers that correctly interpret Unicode. So if you go through and you say, you know, okay, I won't allow HTML encoding. If somebody goes through and let's say you're stripping out script tags, and then you're going through and you say, okay, I'm going to take out, you know, URL encoded data too from this text box where people can put in HTML.
Right.
And you go through and do a couple other things. Well, you know, like they said before with the UTF-7, you know, encoding, you are able to get away from it. There's so many different ways of encoding it that, you know, just doing like a blacklist for the most part is not likely to catch everything.
Yes, input sanitizing input is just one of the biggest ways you can mitigate a lot of stuff, is to just not allow a lot of the tags. Don't allow the greater than, less than. You know, if it's not,
yeah, I mean,
don't
if
allow
you can
anything.
Avoid it.
Yeah,
you can avoid it. Have something that, you know, lets you let them mark a box with text in it and use a drop down to say it's red or something like that.
Right.
But don't allow like any type of special characters whatsoever. You know, like, if you can lock it down as tight as you can, do that. You know, don't just hope that somebody's not going to do it, because eventually somebody probably will.
Right, and yeah. Actually, that's one of the reasons a lot of people probably don't know this, but will relate to this when I explain it, is in most forum software packages, forums, you know, a lot of this people post different things in forums over the years, and that's where a lot of these things have been seen and tested and implemented, is people posting, being able to post HTML. If most forums these days, if you notice, they're using something that's become commonly called BB code, which is basically another way for you to put a URL. Instead of allowing you to put an anchor in there or an image tag, they will have a set of code. It's like usually square brackets, or at least it is in Vision PowerBoard, but most of them are pretty universal with this. And you'll put a bracket called bracket IMG, close bracket, then the link to your image, and then the open bracket slash IMG. It's very close to the same syntax, but it doesn't allow you to put that greater than, less than. It doesn't allow you to insert any kind of HTML or any kind of code like that. So, you know, you prevent a lot of that stuff by sanitizing your input.
Yeah, and another thing is, you know, like tying session cookies to a particular IP address. So you make sure that the IP address of the user is the only one that has access to that cookie. So if you go through and something else tries to request that cookie, even with the same data, you don't allow that.
Mm-hmm.
If the IP address is different but the session is the same, because somebody could hijack your session and you go through and you know, they grab your cookie from another location, well, if you have it tied to the IP address, you can say, there's one open session right now, it's tied to this IP address, and this other IP address is asking for this with the same session data? I don't think so.
Right, and session hijacking is another topic, too, that we could go into more detail about on another show as well, but point certainly well taken.
And you can use different stuff to make sure that any HTML you have on your site is well-formed. So you can use stuff like there's a program called HTML Tidy, and that'll go through and make sure that all of your actual HTML is well-formed. Some of the other ways that you can mitigate these attacks is there's a different one for IE and Firefox. There's the HTTP only flag for the browser if it's IE, and if I remember correctly, that keeps any JavaScript executed on that page from executing JavaScript on another page. And the Firefox equivalent of that is what they call the same origin policy. The same origin policy prevents a document or script loaded from one IP address or domain from getting or setting properties of a document from a different domain. So the policy is pretty much there since, like, Netscape Navigator, like, 2.0. Mozilla considers two pages that have the same domain if the host is basically the same. So they have to have the same base URL in order to actually execute. So that's very handy, and I'd highly recommend it, using both of those, both the HTTP-only flag and the same origin policy, if you can, on your AJAX application. There's some other stuff on the web server Apache. You can go through and set it to use only one character set. You can look at it. You can add an explicit card set, you know, to the specific ISO. I think it's 8859-1. And, well, there's a bunch of other information, but you can Google, you know, setting Apache to use only one character set and make sure that, you know, you won't potentially be exploited by a user going through it and encoding the data in a different way.
Different character set that evaluates to the exact same things you're trying to avoid them from using.
Exactly, and that's the thing with the spread of, you know, so many different languages and you know, moving towards Unicode so that people from multiple nations can use the same web page. You know, they get into it, but the crux of that is that there's so many different ways to encode the data that, you know, it's insane.
Right, yeah. So, like, I'm going to make up an example because I'm not sure if that translates well to the listeners. So, I'm going to make this up as a bad example, but, you know, what equates to the open bracket or to a less than, greater than symbol in your standard character set, you can block that from the ISO 8859-1 that we're talking about. But if you've got another character set support, somebody could send the code for the less than, greater than, equal, which of course are the open and closed tags, through another character set, and if your Apache setup will allow that to happen, it's going to translate them. It is going to allow the less than greater than, because it bypassed your character set using a different character set, and is going to let you do the same thing by basically doing kind of another language, if you will. Pretend that it supports, let's say, English and, I don't know, let's say Spanish, and Spanish character set has a letter that's a less than sign and a greater than sign. You're actually bypassing. In English, you don't have the less than or greater than, but in another language or another character set, which is I'm trying to make the equivalent there, it will allow those characters. So that's what the difference is. I'm not sure if that's going to come across over radio, but that's the best I can come up with to explain.
Well, here's an easy one for anyone that has a browser. They can put in this JavaScript. Here's just a quick little example. You can do alert parens string dot from char code 88, 83, 83. You know, end parens from char code is a function itself. So you go through and do that, right? You have the direct character encoding, the numeric encoding for the actual character. And what that'll do is it'll actually give you an alert that says XSS. You know, wow. One very easy way of saying that, you know, so even though it's just numbers, it's correctly interpreted by the browser as XSS.
Right, it's illustrating the bypassing or the characters being translated correctly.
Exactly. There's right. Numeric and canonical, and these are just merely many different canonical forms of the same, you know, data.
Right, and you've actually done a little bit of research here as we wrap this whole thing up. And I should probably mention that, of course, people can go to wikipedia.org and do a search for cross-site scripting, and you'll find a lot of information and links to a lot of other information from that page. It's actually got some pretty decent information there. But you've been doing some research on this, too, and we had a code example. Did you want to read this on the air? We have this, let's see, it's on Pastebin, right?
Yeah, it's on Facebook.
Okay, so I'll read the URL.
There's actually a German example of the exact exploit that was used on Orkut to actually harvest all of the users' information.
Okay, I'll read the...
I think they actually got passwords via this method. Now, it's all closed up now, but it's a great example.
All right, I'll read the URL then. It's de.pastebin, P-A-S-T-E-B-I-N, .ca/259239. I didn't tiny URL that because it's already pretty short. So, de.pastebin.ca/259239. And that code does... Well, I'm sorry, you had said... I think I interrupted you while you were saying that.
Oh,
It's an example.
No, I mean, aside from that, what I'm currently in the process of writing an automated AJAX vulnerability scanner in JavaScript and Perl. And basically, the Perl end of it is just to process the data and store it in a database and, you know, manage it. So, but primarily, the JavaScript end of it is going through, you know, any XML HTTP request, you know, object calls, any URLs, et cetera, the ID, and then it goes through the entire list and goes through each URL, grabs any additional data, and tries to test to see if it'll accept script injection, and then go back through, and I'm going to provide the new URL if it gives it on the Perl side and go through and see if the vulnerability worked. So I'm working on that right now for my own applications, but I may be releasing the source soon. I think it's actually fairly easy to do with most of the Perl modules, and the JavaScript is straightforward too. If you look at you know, most of the AJAX programming tutorials, I'm sure you can find a couple of things out there on using the XML HTTP request object. But, I mean, the funny thing is, this application could probably be used or written entirely in JavaScript if right. You don't want logging the information and you're just going to write it out to the page. That's one of the other things that I just wanted to close on is that, you know, JavaScript is a lot more powerful than a lot of people give it credit for. There's a lot of things that you can do in JavaScript that would probably flip most, you know, even web developers' mind, you know. Probably a good source to just see the power of it is to, I think Yahoo has their Hackaday talks and whatnot, and they have a couple of people go into advanced JavaScript tutorials, and they go into, you know, how well-formed, you know, it's object-oriented and everything like that, but with the advent of AJAX, you're starting to see people utilize it a lot more, and it's just as exploitable as, you know, any other application code, but you can actually see it on the client side, you know. So, I mean, that's pretty much all I got to say on that. If there's significant interest, I might go a little bit further down the rabbit hole, but I guess that's probably enough information for this show, huh?
Yeah, and let's see. You know, I think we actually did a pretty good job of not making this too awful dry and using some good examples of it, because, again, this is one of those topics that it's easier to look at the code and see the examples. So I think we gave enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's why I was saying, like, with the security scanner, I might release that source soon, or at least probably put up a couple of snippets on the forums, I was thinking, because, you know, a lot of this is probably much easier to see in code than actually describe it. So I, you know, I tried to explain as much as possible, but, you know, a function is worth 1,000 words.
Right. And we'll definitely keep everybody apprised when you give us that stuff. But between the tiny URL example earlier, the paste bin code we can give people a look at. And by the way, I'm going to use that for site of the week. I'm going to be cheap out. Use pastebin.ca as the site of the week. Nice place to post some code snippets if you need to. And let's see, what else to wrap up the show with? Any shouts? So you got some shouts you want to give out?
I'll do shouts to my coworkers. I think they might be listening to the show.
Okay.
And probably shouts to the normal BR561 group and Florida 2600.
Yeah. And let's see, I'll give shouts to, I was talking with Living Dead in IRC earlier, so I'll give him some shouts. And let's see, I think last time I gave shouts to everybody whose handle begins with an E, so this week I'm going to say anybody whose handle begins with an M, as in MiaFlux. And if your handle begins with an M, you get shouts this week.
Yeah, I got shouts.
Yeah, I'm being so lazy on these days.
Are you just going to go, like, the next round and just say, like, this show has given shouts to the letter M, the letter Q,
yeah, like, number five. Like Sesame Street, yes. This show has been sponsored by and made possible by listeners like you. Email us if
we
you have...
We need, like, a contribution page for that.
Yeah, well, no, that's a whole other topic.
I might just exploit, like, the BinRev page to add a PayPal contribution to me.
Yeah, right. We'll see. We'll keep an eye on that, but
on the front page.
If you do have any feedback of any kind for this episode or any episode of the show, you can email us, radio@binrev.com. Closing music this week is from Beefy and DJ Snyder. It's called Twerp, TW3RP. It's the elitized twerp. Oh, from over at songflight.org, what I always find a lot of good music over there. So, Mia Flux, thank you for being on the show, my friend. And
thank you. Actually, and, I did want to add, you know, just like the prior episode, anyone who you know, has special interest or wants some more information or help, just wants to flame me, you can reach me at miaflux@gmail.com. That's MEAFLUX at Gmail.
All right. And stick around after we're done recording, because speaking of BR561, we got some plans to talk about for that. But until then, we will tell everybody that we will see them next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.
Bitches.
Hey, yo, Sny, I want to tell a story. The names and dates have been changed to protect the innocent. Get out your motherfucking seat.
DJ Snyder.
Come on. Nickel plated Nicholas, or nickel for short. The pleasing, charming sort. When we were kids, we used to play Fort. In our younger years, when I was the Green Ranger in my mind's eye, Monday Night Raws, when my kind would rock the tie-dye. Nickel was a cool guy, just after reading sci-fi. Till some knucklehead popular types wanted to hurt my bestest best friend forever. I had to use fists. I never promote violence, but I will promote this. But I couldn't be around 24 hours of the day, and these bastards got their kicks in the most despicable ways. Tell them to shoo away, but insects they keep swarming. Like Norman in the 90s was the way these kids were storming. And the principal did nothing, man, that dude was a jerk. He just called my fat ass lazy and my best friend a twerk. So it was work, 40 plus OT, keeping Nick Bruce free. And it's not like these kids didn't get off while trying to brew. Crack conspiracy when I was getting pulled out of class. Helpless in ISS while they were beating his ass. I wasn't thinking too fast, I was running my mouth. With every syllable, another hurtful night in his house. But I was younger and I was too dumb to figure it out. Yeah, I'm too stubborn and too stupid, that's what I was about. But at night, we meet up with internet.
hairnet and a coat. And even with a life so painful, he was first to tell a joke. And you'll hear what you'll hear, and you'll feel what you'll feel. But Nick produced emotions that was harder to steal. And first-person shooters was a way to escape. This isn't going where you're thinking, I just ask you to wait. You see, over the years, my boy developed his dexterity in raising CPA at the risk of his popularity. And his home situation wasn't ideal, to say the least. So, of course, he was visited daily by the Marines. And the recruiters, they would grill him, and they'd hassle his mom, talking about pride and honor in the hunt for Saddam, and how he has him a bomb, and how it's ready to launch. Let's meet up and talk tomorrow, and we'll buy you some lunch. And if you join with us, you can do whatever you please. I was the first to tell Nicole that this use wasn't worth the squeeze. And I said, yo, I'll protect it till the day I rock a tomb. Hey. That to say, I think those words are what drove him away. End of the day, guess a guy's gotta be his own man, even if that means you're gonna get stationed in Iran. But Nicole, he was smart and not afraid of some work. And after years of working out, no one would call him a twerk. And I was reeling from the hurt when my friend put on the camo and started making jokes about Bin Laden with the camo. When he left, it's like he was already dead in my eyes. A salute and middle finger when we said our goodbyes. And yo, I have me this pride, I won't admit that I cry. When I see the bumper stickers that all resimplify. Never wanted to die, I may be weak, but I'm stronger than that. I just want my motherfucking brother back.